Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Science Friday is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. That's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Nobel physicist Murray Gell-Mann died recently at the age of 89. He was known for his thoughts about quantum mechanics, especially particles like quarks, which he named, and his love of creativity and interdisciplinary thought. We're opening up the Sci-Fi Vault to bring you a conversation I had with him back in August of 1994.
It all came together in a rainforest in Belize. Theoretical physicist Murray Gell-Mann was strolling through the forest, wondering how quantum mechanics, a fundamental tenet of physics, how quantum mechanics could explain individuality. In other words, if all matter is made up of the same basic stuff, how can the universe be filled with such diversity? Well, in the middle of his musings, Dr. Gell-Mann looked up and saw a wild jaguarundi standing on the trail about 100 yards ahead of him. And somehow, the sight of this sleek, black wildcat triggered something in Gell-Mann's brain. One of those, you know, those eureka moments when the light bulb suddenly lights up, and then suddenly he could really see the connections between the simple and the complex. Well, in this hour, we're going to ask Dr. Gell-Mann to share his insights with us and to explain how quantum physics can form the basis for biological evolution, the development of human society and language, and even creative thought. Is the universe essentially comprehensible, and can we ever hope to understand how it all works? Murray Gell-Mann is a professor emeritus of theoretical physics at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1969. He's the author of the new book, The Quark and the Jaguar, published by Freeman and Company. And he's one of the co-founders of the Santa Fe Institute, a think tank for scientists who take a transdisciplinary approach to understanding life, the universe, and everything. Professor Gell-Mann joins us from station KCFR in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here, Ira.
Did I sum up correctly that moment in the jungle there?
Yes, you did a beautiful job.
I was okay. Can you tell us what that, describe that little flash of genius, that moment of insight as it occurred to you there, looking at that animal?
Well, seeing that very individual animal somehow made me think, since I had just been musing about how individuality fits in with quantum mechanics, it made me think that we really know a little bit about the chain of connections from the simple, fundamental, underlying laws that govern all matter in the universe to the rich fabric of complex reality that we see around us and of which we are a part. And so it was at that moment that I decided to write a book about it.
Do we really know the connections, or do we think we know the connections?
Well, we know something about them. And in particular, we know something about them if we look at the universe from the point of view of information. And from that point of view, we can see quite a lot. Mm-hmm. We see that complexity arises from initial order and simple rules together with the operation over and over and over again of chance.
Mm-hmm. And chance is a key part of it.
Yes, it certainly is. What you might call indeterminacy, that is, forks in the road, occasions when things could go different ways, and they go one way out of those, and the different ways have different probabilities. Mm-hmm. So you can think of the history of universe as kind of a branching tree, mm-hmm. constantly branching with probabilities of the different branches.
Albert Einstein, who was not a great believer in chance, although he did agree with you and other scientists of the day in believing that, he said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Would you agree with that?
I suppose we don't know why the underlying laws are simple, but they are. They seem to be, at least. And as to chance, it's true that Einstein had difficulty swallowing quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. Even though he had helped greatly to lay the groundwork for it years before. Even he would have had to admit that from the point of view of any observer, the universe exhibits a phenomenon of chance, because besides quantum mechanical indeterminacy, there's also indeterminacy just from ignorance. You don't know all the details at the beginning of a process. You know only some of them. And so even if the laws of physics were perfectly deterministic, which they're not,
right,
you still couldn't predict the outcome perfectly. And that is made more difficult still by the phenomenon of chaos that occurs sometimes in nonlinear systems, in which the outcome is very, very sensitive to tiny details of the input. So even without quantum mechanics, there's a great deal of indeterminacy. But quantum mechanics introduces a fundamental set of indeterminacies, which are much deeper.
In other words,
that stem merely from ignorance.
There are certain rules it gives you for playing this game, in other words.
For calculating probabilities.
Yeah.
So the way my colleagues and I, who are investigating a new modern approach to quantum mechanics, look at it, we say that quantum mechanics gives probabilities for alternative histories of the universe.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, the future need not go along any single path. It might take an infinite number of directions developed
right.
by roll of the dice, for example.
One roll after another.
That's
just
very,
yeah. Constantly branching. The great Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges, in one of his marvelous imaginative short stories, envisage someone making a model of the branching histories of the universe in the form of a garden of forking paths.
Is it possible to predict the universe quantumly, to find out which one of those garden paths we're going to be taking?
No, that's the whole idea. The whole idea is that in quantum mechanics, it is fundamentally unpredictable.
But everything...
Which alternative will occur. For example, if a... radioactive nucleus decays, emitting mm-hmm. some particle, say an alpha particle. There is no way whatsoever to predict in what direction that alpha particle will go. It can mm-hmm. go in any direction, whatever, and they're all equally probable.
And equally so, quantum mechanics predicts that anything is possible. Given that some things are more probable than others, doesn't it say that anything is possible?
Well, that's a familiar misconception. It's true only in a very peculiar sense, because some things are so improbable mm-hmm. that there's no sense talking about the possibility of their happening. When I studied quantum mechanics first at Yale almost 50 years ago with Henry Margenau, I remember he gave a problem to the class asking what the probability was that some object, a spoon or something, would jump off the table
right.
an inch or two and then fall back by a quantum fluctuation. I forget the exact problem, but it was something of that kind. And the probability came out something like 1 divided by 1 with 62 zeros.
Hmm.
So you can say, well, anything can happen, but anything that's that improbable is effectively impossible. So forget it.
For all practical purposes.
But it's a common misconception that in quantum mechanics anything goes, and all sorts of things which if true, would require revolution in the known laws of science, still would require a revolution in the known laws of science if they were to happen, things like psychokinesis and so on. They aren't any more acceptable in quantum mechanics than they are in classical physics.
If the future is so dependent on possibilities and probabilities, then how do we use it to predict things? How do we get this idea of complexity, of being able to deal with the stock market or to deal with how sand piles will fall down from something that is so uncertain?
Well, it's uncertain only at the level of very light objects and so on. When we deal with heavy macroscopic objects, or more accurately, when we deal with degrees of freedom that have a lot of inertia, such as we deal with in everyday life, then the predictions are much like the predictions of classical physics most of the time. In other words, nearly deterministic, with much less of this freedom, just as I illustrated by that problem about the spoon jumping off the table. It's pretty certain that it will just stay there unless it's disturbed by some normal influence. So the fact that quantum mechanics is probabilistic at root doesn't mean that it applied to the usual kinds of events that we see that it has such a lot of indeterminacy. Doesn't. But at any time, of course, a macroscopic event involving heavy things can be influenced by a quantum fluctuation if they somehow come into connection with each other. That was the point, or at least the sensible point, of this story of Schrödinger's cat. Erwin Schrödinger, one of the discoverers of quantum mechanics, discussed a hypothetical situation in which a radioactive disintegration or something like that, some quantum process, governs whether a cat will be poisoned or not.
Right.
And that's just an example of how you can amplify a quantum fluctuation to become a major disturbance in the world around us. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we could hook up a quantum fluctuation to set off a hydrogen bomb. I'm not suggesting it's a good idea, but could be done in principle and could then determine whether a city is blown up or
right.
not.
Let's go back a second to how that little flash of genius you had there in the jungle and your insight. And let's talk a bit about starting with quarks, which we all know are the same, and then you get into complex systems, which are unique. And in your book, you propose that different complex systems can behave similarly, like biological evolution and the evolution of an economy or human society. How is that possible? How do we make that jump?
Well, if we look at the world, at the universe, from the point of view of information, then we can see some of the links that connect the very simple underlying laws to the complex reality that we see around us. And the operation of chance over and over again is then very important. These accidents, which can turn out one way or another and then turn out in one of those ways, these accidents can often have no very wide-ranging consequences. But sometimes they do have wide-ranging consequences. Large-scale ramifications. For example, a long, long time ago, some little fluctuation gave rise to our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy in which we find ourselves. Now, from the point of view of the whole cosmos, that may not have been very important, but to anything in our galaxy, it's pretty important that it came into existence.
Right.
And similarly, some little accident amplified produced the solar system. And a sequence of accidents produced the various planets, including the Earth. And a whole bunch of other accidents led to the particular ways in which life originated on Earth and the early stages of biological evolution on Earth, and then to the different kinds of plants and animals that evolved, the details of,
right.
of those.
What's fascinating about complexity, though, is that if we would turn the clock back on all these events... and get to those initial conditions and start it again, we're not guaranteed of getting to the same place that we are today, are we?
No, absolutely not. No, not at all. Because of all these chance processes that occur one after another. The accidents that give rise to large-scale correlations to that have ramifications that are widespread. Some of us like to call frozen accidents, like the formation of our galaxy, like the initial form of life that was ancestral to all the other surviving forms of life on Earth, had certain characteristics. And to some extent, every living thing on Earth still has some of those characteristics. For example, in living things all over the Earth, certain right-handed molecules play very important roles, while the corresponding left-handed molecules don't. Now, at one point, certain physicists tried to explain that in terms of the asymmetry between left and right for matter as opposed to antimatter. But it didn't work. And as far as anyone knows, it's purely an accident. It's just that the ancestral life form happened to have these right-handed molecules playing important roles, and it's been true ever since. So that's a beautiful example of a frozen accident.
Beautiful example of how life is unfair, right?
Now, complexity means many different things. But in the book, The Quark and the Jaguar, having examined many different possible definitions of complexity, I conclude that the one that comes closest to what we usually mean by complexity in everyday speech and even in a great deal of scientific discourse is the length of a very concise description of the regularities of a system, not including fluctuations judged to be random, but regularities. Hmm. Now, where do regularities come from? They can come either from the simple underlying fundamental laws that govern all matter in the universe, or they can come from one of these frozen accidents, or many of these frozen accidents. Hmm. So as time goes on, as the universe gets older, there's more and more opportunity for accidents and for some of those to be frozen accidents, and therefore more and more opportunity for regularities to arise. And consequently, more and more opportunities for greater complexity to arise.
So I guess this would be like mutations in biology, then. You might look at them in the same way.
A mutation that survives.
Yes. Right.
And that has profound consequences later on for many things would be an example of a frozen accident.
All right. Let's go to the phones because lots of people would like to ask you nice questions, I hope. Bob Bogg in Ames, Iowa. Hi.
Hello. My question was, I took this quantum physics several years ago, and, you know, for example, for finding the position of, let's say, an electron inside the potential barrier, what we do, we solve the equation and solve the Schrödinger's equation, and we get to find the eigenfunctions. I had 2-3 years time to think about it. It seems to me that we are missing an equation. If we had the extra equation that is needed, we can precisely locate, for example, where the, how do you call it, electron is inside that potential well or something like that. Another thing that I thought about this is, you know, maybe we are, you know, like if we saw the world with the sound wave instead of, let's say, light wave, our uncertainty would be totally calculated differently because it's, as you know, h bar over the pi.
Babak, you got to have to be a little less technical for us on this.
Have you
got a general question?
A little less technical, but you know, as your guest would know, it's really hard to talk about it less technical.
I know.
I would hope that your
I don't know exactly what you mean, I'm sorry to say, but I can try to guess a little bit about what you mean.
Okay.
Many people, when they study quantum mechanics, are disappointed that it doesn't turn out to be fully deterministic, like the old-fashioned classical physics, which is now known to be only an approximation to quantum mechanics. And the great Albert Einstein, in his old age, also found it difficult to accept. Nevertheless, it's true that quantum mechanics works. It's right.
But Einstein thought that quantum mechanics was okay for now, but it's not the ultimate solution. Is there something beyond quantum mechanics that is agreed there might be?
Many people have hoped many people who are dissatisfied with the fundamentally probabilistic character of quantum mechanics have hoped that somehow what would turn out to be right instead was some kind of deterministic theory underneath plus a lot of little sources of uncertainty, little bees buzzing around that you have to average over. And when you average over those, you would get back the results that are confirmed for quantum mechanics. But the underlying theory would be really deterministic. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what our caller was hoping also. Now, it turned out some years ago, it was noticed that there's certain experiments that can distinguish between the two situations, between quantum mechanics and an alternative, rival, hypothetical theory in which that would be deterministic, but with some kind of random processes obscuring the determinism. Mm-hmm. And those experiments have been done, and quantum mechanics came out right.
Mm-hmm. It's been called one of the most successful theories. But there's still people, because there are so many probabilities involved, and because physicists, especially theoretical physicists, look like they're getting away with murder sometimes, because they can make these incredible projections without having to test them. That people think that, you know, what a great job this is to be a theoretical physicist because no one can prove you wrong.
Well, that's completely incorrect. The whole idea of science is to make predictions that can ultimately be tested in some way.
Ultimately, but maybe not in our lifetime.
Well, in my experience, fortunately, I've been very, very fortunate in that my predictions in elementary particle physics have been verifiable not only in the lifetime, but within a few years of when they were made. And most of them, I'm particularly fortunate in that most of them turned out to be right. it's very satisfying. But science does not consist of, I mean, not just physics, no kind of science consists of speculation that can never be verified. That's contrary to the whole idea of science, which is to check with nature constantly, repeatedly check with nature as to whether what you're saying has any validity. When the Royal Society of London was founded in 1660, the motto was nullius in verba, or in English Latin, nullius in verba. And I interpret that to mean not through anyone's words. In other words, don't trust Aristotle. Check with nature.
I once interviewed a physicist who was, and it's pointed out the great difference between theoretical physicists and experimental physicists. And I had to get to this guy by going down into a mine that was 2,000 feet below the surface. I took down a taconite mine in Minnesota. This gentleman had set up a large concrete cube down there, and he was looking, and this is many years ago, you'll remember when decaying protons were very bit vogue, and people were trying to figure out whether the proton has a real lifetime and you can detect its decay and what that lifetime was. It was 10 to the 28th or something like that. And he was down there with his little device that had flashing lights, hoping that the light would flash when, you know, a proton decay would happen. And I remember remarking to him, saying, you know, aren't you afraid that when we open the door and go inside and look at this, just at that point, the light's going to flash and you're going to miss it? He said, that's the least of my worries. He said, I'm really worried about the theoretical physicists because they can be up there on their blackboards at Cambridge and they can say, oh, well, maybe the proton isn't 10 to the 28th or maybe it's 10 to the 26th or maybe it's 10 to the 30th. And they just smudge out the 28 and put a 30 or put a 26 in there, and there they go off to have lunch. Here, I've got to stay down there another 10 years because they've changed that number one digit. So it was driven home to me that the difference between theoretical physicists and guys who actually have to make the experiments, and at sometimes it appears, for example, with superstring theory, which we've talked about on this program before, there may be no way to actually test this theory using atom smashers or particle accelerators that are around
today. That's another misconception, which unfortunately some of my colleagues have helped to propagate. I don't know why.
It's a conspiracy against you, probably.
No, not against me, but not at all. Let's explain for the benefit of the listeners about superstring theory. For the first time in the history of science, we have in the last few years been presented with a plausible candidate for the role of unified quantum field theory of all of the elementary particles and all of their interactions. In other words, the ultimate microscopic physical theory. Superstring theory passes the various tests that people have been able to devise for it so far as a theory. And it's then very exciting to see, as you say, to what extent it can be tested against observation. Now, the first prediction is of Einstein's gravitational theory, general relativity. And that seems to be right. It's been checked a number of times.
So by experiment.
By observation. Right. So it's passed a beautiful test in that it predicts it. Second, it's the only theory that anyone has ever seen that gives Einstein's gravitational theory in quantum mechanics together with other quantum mechanical forces and without leading to crazy infinities in the perturbation expansion. Those infinities have made other attempts to describe gravitation quantum mechanically fail.
Right.
But here, it's not true. The theory seems to make perfect sense, even in a perturbation expansion, and allows the description not only of gravitation, but of other forces as well. The next test should be whether it can lead to the so-called standard model, which describes physics up to the energies, describes quite well physics up to the energies at which the experiments have been done. I'm one of the people that have worked all these years on constructing the standard model, and we're naturally terribly proud of it because it's very successful. But it clearly is not the ultimate theory of the elementary particles and their interactions. There are many reasons why, but it just contains a large number of undetermined of quantities that have to be determined by observation. It contains a large number of particles without explaining why.
So there'd be another theory after that superstring theory.
So there must be another. And superstring theory... the standard model.
Oh, the standard model.
And superstring theory could be that theory. But we have to check that it really leads to the standard model. Once it's seen that it can lead to the standard model, then there's the possibility that it can predict some of the quantities which otherwise have to be determined purely by observation in the standard model. So there's another way to test it. Beyond that, there will be some corrections to the standard model from superstring theory, and it will be possible to test those. The most exciting test is that superstring theory predicts that for every known elementary particle, there is a new particle, a partner, super partner, at a higher mass with somewhat different properties, but properties that can be predicted. And one of the most exciting possibilities for new accelerators is that they may be able to surmount this super gap in energy and produce the super partners of the known particles, or at least some of them. It's not known for sure how big that super gap is, and it might be very large and inaccessible to new accelerators, but there is some evidence today from the analysis of observations that super gap may not be very large, that it may be such that these superparticles will be accessible to experiments in a new accelerator.
We're talking this hour about simplicity, complexity, everything in between. My guest is Murray Gell-Mann, who is co-founder of the Santa Fe Institute in New Mexico and author of the new book, The Quark and the Jaguar, published by Freeman. Dr. Gell-Mann, let me finish that thought about superstring theory. Are you saying that if we do get a powerful accelerator that can jump this gap and find that next plateau particle, that will really cement the superstring theory because nothing else predicts it?
Well,
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Finding some of these super partners of the known particles would certainly be a powerful argument in favor of the correctness of superstring theory. The standard model would then be enlarged at least to a superstandard model containing these super partners, but that wouldn't prove completely the correctness of superstring theory. In fact, such a thing can never be done. You can never prove once and for all
the validity of an underlying fundamental theory.
What you can do, though, is to subject it to as many tests as possible. But the statement that it can't be tested by observation is not correct.
Let's talk about speculation, because that seems to be one of the key reasons for having the Santa Fe Institute, is that people get together and try different approaches of collaboration. You bring a, tell us a little bit about what happens there. We've had people talk about it before, but never someone who can really give us an insider's look about what your goal in creating it was and why I guess you believe that strict scientific approaches to ideas are can be more fruitful if you bring other people in this, into the process.
In many cases, yes. That is, we believe very much in specialization. We think specialization is necessary, inevitable, and good, as we know more and more, learn more and more about the world around us. But we believe that specialization needs to be supplemented by integrative thinking, and that right now there's this kind of imbalance, that there's a great need for competent integrative thinking. Bringing together specialists in a great many fields, from mathematics and physics and chemistry through several kinds of biology to psychology, economics, political science, history, and so on, and to have them share their insights, but not in general, but in pursuing certain kinds of issues. And the synthesis, the grand synthesis that we are hoping to pursue concerns looking at the world in terms of information and trying to understand simplicity and complexity, and especially complex adaptive systems, which are systems that can learn or adapt or evolve the way living things evolve.
A lot of people would, there's that the Gaia principle or the theory that I'm sure you're familiar with. Is that an adaptive sort of system where people think that the Earth is changing to meet some of the insults and challenges that are put on it?
As I understand it, it's a proposal that not only the living things on the Earth are adaptive, but that the whole system of Earth plus living things is in some sense adaptive, but it's not generally accepted.
A lot of scientists look at outsiders like philosophers or people who are not involved in the scientific community as just kibitzers along the way. That they are, it's nice to have them around, talk to them at cocktail parties. You'd have them, maybe you'd have your daughter marry one, but they don't really add anything to fostering advances in knowledge. I imagine that that's not true in your philosophy at the Santa Fe Institute. Or is it?
Well, I don't know that we've had a significant number of philosophers.
Well, I'm not speaking specifically just about philosophers. I just use them as an example, but other people who are not involved in this in science.
My wife is a poet. My
artists,
wife, Marcia Southwick, is a poet.
Right.
And she and I are trying to put together, it's been postponed several times through nobody's fault, but we're trying to put together some seminars on simplicity and complexity in the arts, for example. And we certainly have had a number of people from the arts visiting. And we even had one preliminary discussion of simplicity and complexity in the arts in which we brought together a few kinds of creative artists and some of the Santa Fe Institute scientific researchers. It was actually very good.
All right. We have someone who would like to ask you about the poetry, Stephen from Lorain, Ohio. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. The reason why I called is actually I've been thinking about the same thing he's been thinking about for probably 5 or 10 years. And as I look at entropy and enthalpy and the things that could happen, you know, just as I fried up a pan of bacon, you know, every little strip of bacon is like some snowflakes, you know. It's not an endorsement for eating bacon. But I wrote a poem about it. Being his wife is a poet, maybe you might want to hear it.
A short poem? Long poem?
It's 4 words.
Oh, well. Go ahead.
It's called the Divergence Coefficient. And it's all lowercase. It's called The Odds Are Gods.
That's it. The odds are gods.
That's it.
Are you looking for a critique?
Well, when people...
No, not at all. I just thought it might add to the discussion.
That would certainly fit in with quantum mechanics, would it not?
Well, it's curious that when scientists use that word god or gods as some kind of metaphor for things in science, they sometimes mean the underlying laws, the fundamental laws, for example, superstring theory, if it's correct. And sometimes they mean the chance processes that are completely unpredictable. And you can never tell when somebody uses that, is going to use that word about science, which metaphor will be chosen. In this case, it's the chance processes that are selected to be labeled that way. Albert Einstein used to talk about the fundamental laws as the secrets of the old one, just the opposite metaphor. It's quite amusing.
All right, Stephen. That's a nice little poem. The odds are gods. I like that. Thanks a lot for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Enjoy the show.
Have a good weekend. Let me ask you about creative thinking. You talk about thinking, creative thought in your book. As someone who was obviously a well-known creative thinker, are creative thinkers born, or do you learn how to think creatively?
Well, I don't address that issue so much. I mean, not the part about being born, as I do the question of how it happens and whether it can be taught, which is the second part of your question. I'm sure that people who make huge strides in art, in science, in many other fields, often have some unusual endowment, genetic endowment. The people at the very top of a profession, just the way we believe that a very great ball player or a very great musician probably has some unusual endowment. But at the next level, most people, or a great many people at least, can attain the next to highest level in a great many fields. And so it's probably not so much a matter of genetic equipment as it is accident and learning. But with creative ideas, the getting of a creative idea, as I discuss in the book, involves jumping over some kind of barrier from the existing patterns of thought to some other pattern of thought, which is more successful. And usually we have to wait for that to happen spontaneously, sort of leakage through the barrier. We fill ourselves with some problem, and then there comes a point when further conscious effort doesn't do any more good, and the whole system is not obviously, not on the surface at least, doing any work. But then all of a sudden, in an odd moment, while cooking or shaving or running or something like that, or in one of my cases, by a slip of the tongue, an idea suddenly appears. And it looks subjectively as if the mind has been working on this problem out of awareness, but we don't know if that's really true, but it certainly looks that way. In any case, is there some way of learning to do that quicker so that you don't have to wait for the spontaneous process, which may take a very long time? And some people who claim to teach thinking skills, including creative thinking skills, say that maybe you can hasten the process, for example, by introducing a random element into the situation. One such teacher suggests using the last noun on the front page of today's newspaper to solve your problem, whatever that noun is and whatever your problem is. It's just a way of introducing a random perturbation, a little bit of noise.
Either be Simpson or healthcare will be the last word.
And that, yeah, something like
that.
A little bit of noise that might just jump you over the barrier between the pattern of thought that was conventional and the new one that will help to make progress.
All right, let's go to the phones and ask have some people who want to ask you some concrete questions. Darren from San Francisco. Hi, Darren.
Yeah, good afternoon. I was calling, first of all, I remember that story from Borges. It's a great one. And there's also an interesting bit in Nabokov's book, Ada, the last 70 pages or so, discussing time and probability and things.
Vladimir Vladimirovich Nabokov.
Yes.
He was a great a collector of butterflies.
Yes, he was. He was, and flowers and such as well. My question is regarding an article that I picked up and I don't have in front of me, and the names are evading me at the moment, in Wired about 3 months ago, discussing three physicists in your neck of the woods, actually in Santa Fe, I believe, who were doing some work with, I believe, massively parallel processing and utilizing quantum mechanics to do predictions and such for the stock market. And they were getting massive amounts of funding from major corporations that were contractually wanted to remain anonymous. And also the results, of course, were remaining anonymous. But I was wondering if you could give me your kind of insight on that.
Our caller is partially correct. In the world, and in this country in particular, there are a number of people who are trying to use quantitative methods to look at fluctuations in financial markets and see if they can predict something about the future behavior of the financial markets from that. Some economists have labeled that a hopeless undertaking, saying that the departures from fundamentals are just a random walk. But there's a lot of evidence now that that's not true, that the fluctuations are in part deterministic, chaotic or near chaotic, but deterministic, and that therefore it is possible to profit by studying fluctuations and trying to predict the future. It doesn't mean that everybody who claims to do it can do it, but it seems to be in principle possible.
Well,
indeed, a couple of researchers from New Mexico, colleagues of ours, quit their scientific jobs to form an investment firm. They didn't use quantum mechanics. They just used the theory of deterministic near chaos and chaos, things of that kind, to study fluctuations in certain markets and try to predict something about future fluctuations around fundamentals. They, of course, can't predict the changes in fundamentals, but they can predict the fluctuation, something about, some information about the fluctuations. And they did get some funding indirectly from a Swiss bank. First, they played with play money for a few months and made money in pretend mm-hmm. money.
Right.
And after that, the Swiss bank, through an intermediary, sent them some funds. And if they do well, they'll get more investment from that bank. And so far, they are doing pretty well, I understand.
Huh.
And giving further evidence, therefore, that it's not totally insane to draw conclusions from fluctuations about future fluctuations.
That shows you that that using chaos theory can produce money.
Exactly.
Right. From fees. No. Oh, thanks for calling, Darren. Oh,
thank you very much.
Let's go to Jerry in Kirkland, Washington. Hi, Jerry.
I hope you'll indulge me. I'm a kibitzer. And not too long ago in a popular magazine someplace, I was reading about Stephen Hawking's radiation, which, if real, is a disconnection of radiation from the black hole that spawns it. And that was said to be horrifying to scientists because it signified the loss forever of information that could never be obtained. And I'm mystified by how radiation or those physical properties can be seen as information.
Oh, well, if we have a few minutes, I can try to explain that.
You have two.
2 minutes, okay. Stephen Hawking proposed, and everybody agrees with it, that black holes gradually will lose energy through emitting two or three or four elementary particles at once, some of which go out and others go in. That's the Hawking radiation. There's no controversy about that. It was a very clever thing to point out, and people agree on it. But he then has the idea that a black hole will then ultimately disappear, leaving nothing as a result of this radiation, and that's not a conclusion that's shared by everybody. If it happens, then the quantum mechanical phase information that was contained in the black hole might be lost forever. That's a possible interpretation, and scientists or theorists have been arguing about that ever since. It's not a clearly settled or clearly understood point at this time. Nor is it known for sure if Stephen's idea is correct, that the black hole disappears, leaving nothing. But it's a very interesting subject of controversy.
But if no one sees that radiation and influences it, does it exist?
Oh, the radiation, some of the radiation comes out.
But the stuff that is not seen or goes
no, no.
in?
No, some of the radiation comes out. For example, an electron-positron pair might be produced outside the black hole. The electron might come out, the positron might go in. Mm-hmm. It's not that this radiation doesn't come from the interior of the black hole. It comes from out at the edge of where things can still get away.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you before we leave. I know you're on the new White House Science Advisory Committee.
Yes.
You have any idea? Give us some secrets about what to expect in science policy coming up.
Well, I don't know about secrets. I certainly haven't been told any secrets so far.
Well, what would you? I know.
And,
well,
I, you if know. I had been, I wouldn't tell them to you, especially not on the radio. But it's easy to see that there are a number of questions of policy in various domains where some scientific and technical advice would be useful, and particularly questions that transcend various government departments. And I was on such a committee 25 years ago. The analogous committee at that time was called the President's Science Advisory Committee, and I served on it 25 years ago, and we studied all kinds of things, and we had wonderful briefings on the situation in a great many different areas.
And how does it compare?
We tried to give some useful advice.
And how does that experience compare with this one?
Well, we haven't met yet. Oh. You know, the new one hasn't met yet. So they're trying to arrange for some compromise between the scientists' schedules and the president's schedule and so on, and we'll see how it works out. But the first meeting is yet to be held.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
It was a pleasure, Ira. Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Murray Gell-Mann, Professor Emeritus of Physics at the California Institute of Technology and author of the book The Quark and the Jaguar from W.H. Freeman and Company.
That interview was from 1994. Dr. Murray Gell-Mann, who died recently at the age of 89, our condolences to friends and family. We'll see you next Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.